Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
And Mr. DeSantis, I'm going to direct this next question to you. On live TV in August, on the first day of the general election campaign, you said of Andrew Gillum's run for governor, quote, "The last thing we need to do is to monkey this up by embracing a socialist agenda." Fox News quickly disavowed your words, saying, quote, "They do not condone the language." Now, you called some of this response absurd. You've made appearances at four of David Horowitz's Freedom Center events, again, four separate times, four speeches, among some of Mr. Horowitz's statements, quoting here, "This country's only serious race war is against whites." You know, I'll ask the questions. Okay. It's not a McCarthy game, and I'm giving it. Wait for the question,
okay.
Sir.
Okay.
He also said, "If blacks are oppressed in America, why isn't there a black exodus?" Now, in 2015, in your speech before the Freedom Center, you said of Mr. Horowitz, "David has done such a great work, and I've been an admirer. I've been to these conferences in the past, and I've been a big admirer of an organization that shoots straight, tells the American people the truth, and standing up for the right thing." Those are his words. Here's my question.
He had not even made those statements then.
Yes, he had, sir. The first statement was made many years ago.
How the hell am I supposed to know every single statement somebody makes? Here's the deal. Let me just say this straight up. I've lived my life, whether it's athletics, whether it's military, whether it's serving as a prosecutor. You know, when I was downrange in Iraq, we worked together as a team, regardless of race. We had the American flag on our arm. We wore the same uniform, and we fought for the country. When I was a prosecutor, I stood up for victims of every race, color, and creed. That's the only way to do it in our country. It's something I believe in, and as governor, I will represent all the people. Everyone will get a fair shake. But I am not going to bow down to the altar of political correctness. I'm going to not let the media smear me like they like to do with so many other people.
Sir,
I'm certainly not going to take anything from Andrew Gillum, who's endorsed the Dream Defenders, which says Israel is an apartheid state, and which says the police and prisons have no place in justice.
Mr. Gillum, wait for the applause and go. And Mr. DeSantis, I'll point out, I wish you would have waited for the question, because I had a question, and it's not what you think it is. Mr. Gillum, I'll give you a chance to respond now.
Well, let me first say, my grandmother used to say, a hit dog will holler. And it hollered through this room. Mr. DeSantis has spoken. First of all, he's got neo-Nazis helping him out in the state. He has spoken at racist conferences. He's accepted a contribution and would not return it from someone who referred to the former president of the United States as a Muslim, N-I-G-G-E-R. When asked to return that money, he said no. He's using that money to now fund negative ads. Now, I'm not calling Mr. DeSantis a racist. I'm simply saying the racists believe he's a racist.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record.
Right.
I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay. Give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
He's accepted a contribution and would not return it from someone who referred to the former president of the United States as a Muslim, N-I-G-G-E-R. When asked to return that money, he said no. He's using that money to now fund negative ads. Now, I'm not calling Mr. DeSantis a racist. I'm simply saying the racists believe he's a racist.
But, Mr. DeSantis, if I would ask the audience to please let Mr. DeSantis now respond.
The conference I attended was keynoted by a Medal of Honor recipient named Clint Romache. It was not a racial conference. That is an absolute lie. And I'm not going to sit here and take this nonsense from a guy like Andrew Gillum, who always plays the victim, who's going out and attacking, aligning himself with groups who attack our men and women in law enforcement, attack our military. He still will not disavow the Dream Defenders. None of these things people are saying that I endorse. He endorsed the Dream Defenders, and they endorsed him, and that is wrong.
Mr. Gillum.
Yes. Yeah, happy to speak on that. So first of all, he continues to attempt to manipulate my record to mean that I'm against law and order. First of all, under my leadership as the mayor of the city of Tallahassee, we hired 50 new law enforcement officers. We connected those law enforcement officers hand in glove with the community through community policing. In my city, we're experiencing a five-year low in our crime rate. He described in the last debate a city run amok, and the political fact had to correct him on that as well. What Mr. DeSantis shows is he simply has no relationship with the truth. He doesn't have it here as a candidate, and he certainly wouldn't have it as the governor, but we won't have to worry about that because we'll retire him on November 6th and keep it moving.
I'd like to move on if we could. I'll give you 30.
Give you 30. Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, October 31st, 2018. So I have been told. I hope everyone survived. If you had office parties or any other shenanigans associated with the day, turn your porch light off. That would be my recommendation. Trying to be constructive for the evening. Before we get into any of the information from the debate and lots of really important information. I hope if we have listeners in the Florida area, you should definitely take the opportunity to dial in, ask a question, share your views. But before we get started, you heard the suspected racist white candidate for governor, Ron DeSantis. He accused the black candidate, Andrew Gillum, of playing the victim. Should resonate for a lot of reasons, especially for folks on this program. But just to put things in historical context, we have a historian with us. For the state of Florida, I just want to list some of the victims of anti-black violence. Dr. Harry T. Moore, heard that clip before we got started. Ruby McCollum, we were just talking about her a few weeks ago. All of the black children at the Dozier School in Florida, we talked about that. Antoinette Harrington, she was on the program. Certainly all of the victims of Rosewood, Trayvon. I mean, it would be a long list of victims just in the state of Florida. Mac Charles Parker, lots of them, long list of them. And in fact, you can get outstanding information to document the long history of victims, not playing, documented. Established fact, victims of white terrorism just in the state of Florida. Phenomenal book, The Beast in Florida, History of Anti-Black Violence. We discussed it on the program in 2013. If you are a black resident of Florida, it is mandatory you should have that text in your library. Really, if you study racism, period, just really important book to read and study. His most recent book, A History of Florida Through Black Eyes. Always a pleasure. So glad we could have him back with us to discuss the governor's race as well as the arrest of alleged pipe bomber Cesar Sayoc right in the Sunshine State of Florida. He was allegedly obsessed with Mr. Gillum, candidate for governor. To put all this in some sort of context, joining us once again, historian, author, Dr. Marvin Dunn. Dr. Dunn, you with us, sir?
I sure am. Yes.
Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your evening. Don't know if we disrupted your trick-or-treating plans or you were going to be doing something else with your time, but thank you so much for coming.
It's just as well. I'd much rather be doing this.
Likewise. For any listeners, maybe they missed you back in 2013, anything you would like to share with folks about who you are and the work that you do before we get started?
Well, I was born in Florida in 1940. I lived most of my life in Florida. My parents were migrant workers. My dad was an orange picker in Central Florida. We moved to Miami in 1951 when I was 11 years old. I eventually went to Morehouse College in Atlanta, and then I was a naval officer for about 7 years. I served on aircraft carriers, and then I went to graduate school at the University of Tennessee for my doctorate in psychology. Following that, I worked for a short time as a school psychologist here in Miami, and then in 1972, I joined the faculty of the new Florida International University. I taught there for 35 years. My specialty was race relations and ethnic conflict. My first book was on the Great Riot of 1980 here in Miami, which was a defining moment historically for this community. And then I've written about race relations since that time, other books, and certainly several articles for newspapers around the country. I'm now retired. I was chairman of the psychology department when I retired, and I'm now working on a book on this campaign, as a matter of fact.
Wow, that is amazing. When do you think your book on this campaign will be done?
I want to get it finished by the first 100 days of the Gillum administration. I want to give Andrew 100 days to be in office so that we can see what changes he has made, which directions he intends to take the state. And then I'll have the book published and possibly out maybe with by the summer.
Wow. I'm just doing this, you know, for the drama of it all. If I were a racist, I would accuse you of being uppity, Dr. Dunn, and say, wait a minute now.
I am uppity. You wouldn't be the first one to make that accusation. And I don't take offense because it's true.
Okay. Well,
I can get uppity. Don't let me get uppity on you.
Okay. So uppity Dr. Dunn, how dare you go ahead and presume that Andrew Gillum is going to be the next governor of Florida? What happens if Ron DeSantis is victorious?
Well, the book would still be needed because history is being made as we speak. No black person has gone this far ever in Florida politics. So even if Andrew is defeated, the fact that this race happened at all is worthy of historical note. But that will not be the case. We have every reason to believe that if things continue as they are, he will be victorious. He remains ahead in the polls. We've seen no polling that has put DeSantis ahead of Gillum. Although, you know, one has reason to be apprehensive about polls since we had a very surprise election for president a couple of years ago. But I think the indications that I'm seeing around Florida, I've never seen anything like it. And as I said, I grew up here, spent most of my life here. I've never seen this degree of excitement, not just among black people, but of course among African Americans. Any place you go, this man is a rock star. In fact, the title of my book is Black Star Rising, How Florida Elected Its First African American Governor. So he has taken hold of this state in a way that I have not seen done by any politician. His reach goes well beyond the black community. Keep in mind, Andrew Gillum could not be elected governor if every black voter in Florida voted for him. He needs support from the white community. He needs support from the youth vote. He needs support from the progressive in the Hispanic community. He has to carry a very broad sweep of support in order to win this race, and he appears to be doing that. He has gotten the endorsements of most of the major newspapers in Florida, including the Miami Herald, the Palm Beach Post, the Tampa Bay Times, and others, because people see this man for what he is. He is the new generation of black politicians in this country. And once we get him ensconced in the governorship of Florida for a couple of terms, we're going to be looking at Washington for this man.
Wow. High ambitions for Mr.
No, he is, Andrew Gillum is Florida's Obama. We have our own homegrown Obama in this man. And we think we can take him far. Right now we need him to win this race and show the country what kind of leadership he can provide, and particularly how he can bring the state of Florida together. And we are as fractured in this state as any other state in the union at this point. And we now have a candidate that has the ability to reach out across racial lines and ethnic lines and bring people into his fold. Now, mind you, there will always be some who will never join Andrew, who will never join in this great effort. Mr. DeSantis has the far right wing of the political body politic in Florida behind him. Of course, he has Mr. Trump behind him, and that's no accident. He speaks Trump's language. He plays by Trump's playbook. He even had his child in a commercial, a very young baby of his on a in a commercial early on in the race, reading to him from a Trump book and stacking up play blocks to build a wall that Trump talks about. So we know the cloth from which Mr. DeSantis is cut. And I don't mind saying I'm not approaching this book or this campaign as a nonpartisan. I just came in an hour ago from campaigning on the street for Andrew Gillum. So I'm biased against Gillum, for Gillum, excuse me, and I readily admit that, proudly admit that.
Context of white supremacy. I definitely want to get your thoughts more on the race and certainly what happened with the most recent debate. But I just wanted to go back to one thing that you mentioned in your introduction. You talked about being a native of Florida and your parents working in an orange grove. And that that reminded me of one of my all-time favorite books, top five, Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns. And she has historian, I told you. She has a significant portion of that book where she talks about the experience of black citrus pickers in Florida and the types of racism that they face. In fact, it was George Starling, if I remember correctly, where he had to flee Florida. He was trying to organize black orange pickers. He was trying to organize them, and whites got so angry that they were going to kill him, and he had to catch the train out. And she said that was victims, not playing the victim.
You know,
go ahead. Yes,
you know, I don't want to go too far afield. I'm glad you mentioned that because the first major civil rights case that I became involved in Florida involved black orange pickers in central Florida that worked for a very large citrus company named, I won't name them, but they were one of the largest citrus growers in Florida. And all of the, of course, orange pickers were black and all the supervisors were white. And I was brought into this case as a civil rights expert because the white foreman, the white supervisors, were demanding sex from the black female workers in order for them to get hours on the job. They were simply raping them in the orange groves. This is 1984, 85 when this happened. And the orange company lost that suit because it was established that these things were happening. So it was not just a matter of them suppressing blacks as they aspired to rise up in the company. They were actually raping black women in the fields, in the groves, in return for the privilege of them being able to work. So you don't need to reach all the way back to the 1940s when my father was picking oranges in Florida to find the kind of abuse of blacks that was being heaped upon agricultural workers in this state. And it may still be going on.
Context of white supremacy. Is that, could you point us to a book that you would encourage us to get more information on what you just shared with us?
Well, the case I just mentioned has not been written up. It was a major civil rights case, so there's no written report on that except for the federal documents involved. I guess I would just have to make the reference to my own work on Black Florida because I've covered a number of the issues that we're talking about. The history of Florida through black eyes covers the economic circumstances of blacks in Florida since actually going back to the arrival of the Spanish. So I guess I would ask people to begin with that. But there are other works on Florida history that one can search and find instances in which the subject of race has been covered. Dr. Tamika Hobbs, H-O-B-B-S, is a colleague of mine who has written extensively. One has but to Google her, and her work will come up. She's very, very much involved in writing about the circumstances in Florida. So I would make that recommendation very easily.
Much obliged.
You know, of course, Laura Neale Hurston has also written about Florida in great detail, too. Now, she's a classic, absolutely this incredible writer, one of the best writers in the history of the country. So her work is like one has but to Google Zora Neale Hurston, and you'll find that her work is also very, very explicative of race in Florida.
We just read Zora Neale Hurston's the story of the last black cargo, the book that was recently released. That's not Florida history.
Yes, I just read that myself.
Oh, okay. Well, we're
yes,
right.
I didn't mean to cut you off. Yes, yeah, very, very provocative book. Came out way, way too late, but yes, it just came out, I think, last year. A very engaging book.
We had a lot to say. We read that on the book club, as well as The Warmth of Other Suns. But in reading mm-hmm. that book, I found a lot of the articles, I won't say all, but I mean dozens of the articles that Zora Neale Hurston wrote during the trial for Ruby McCollum, talk about Florida history, another victor, and right in line. I am sure you are familiar
right.
with Ruby McCollum. Can you just give our listeners a snippet of Ruby McCollum, Florida history?
Oh, yes. I've been to Live Oak several times in researching that story. Ruby McCollum was a black woman who was married to a black man, and the two of them were Bolita legends, which is a gambling enterprise. She was one of the richest black women in Florida, in the county. And she took up with a black white physician and had a child by him. And got into a relationship that lasted several years. Her husband knew about it, although he was doing his own thing outside of the marriage. But Ruby one day went to the doctor's office, and this doctor was about to run for governor of Florida, and she killed him. And her trial became swallowed worldwide because we had never seen an instance in which a black woman killed a white lover, particularly someone of the stature of the man that she killed. In any case, she was tried for this and was sentenced to death. It was a sham trial. By the time she really was engaged in the trial itself, she was mentally ill. She was probably mentally ill when she shot the doctor, actually. But she was sentenced to death, and eventually the sentence was commuted, and she did get out of prison. But she was one of two black women on death row in Florida back when she was convicted of this killing. I think it was in the early 1950s that this happened. And she eventually got out of the mental institution, was discharged from it, lived the last few years of her life with her family, and then passed on.
Zora Neale Hurston, you talked about the global attention that case attracted. Zora Neale Hurston covered that case for the Pittsburgh Courier and wrote like mm-hmm. dozens of articles about the trial and her story. It's fascinating information. I tried to download as many as I could and put a file online just a few weeks ago to share about that guy. I never heard about it either. It was fascinating. Florida history, I said, it is so rich in terms of studying, understanding the history of white supremacy. And that's kind of the reason that I'm bringing all of this up in context to get a better understanding of this governor's race. And you said the hit worthy of a book of Mr. Gillum even being in this position in the state of Florida. Why I would have some apprehension, even though I'm glad that you have that optimism, confidence that he's going to be victorious. But I do have some, I guess, suspicion that some of these whites might not be being truthful about who they're actually going to vote for. What did you think of the most recent debate? It took place last week. That was where the sound clip from the introduction for the program came from. Racism came up quite a few times. Mr. DeSantis was asked about mm-hmm. his comment about, you know, let's not monkey around and elect, you know, Mr. Yeah. Gillum, have him in office, as well as some of the speeches that he's gave, how some of these racists basically have been supporting his campaign. What stood out to you from the debate?
Yeah. Well, you know, particularly the first debate, and indeed even into the second one, I was reminded of the Nixon-Kennedy debate back in the 60s when Richard Nixon appeared nervous, uncomfortable, shifty, his clothes didn't fit him. He had trouble directly answering questions, whereas Kennedy was smooth, suave, on point, never appeared to be riled, and had makeup on that made him look as handsome as he was. So it was kind of a mismatch just in appearance and presentation between the debaters. Then Mr. DeSantis had the problem of being unable to answer questions directly in both debates. It was very difficult to get him to stay within the rules of the debate itself, and he danced around some of the most important questions that were put to him. That's necessary in his case because DeSantis is running on Donald Trump. That's all he has to hang on to, and many of Donald Trump's policies do not resonate with a great many white Floridians. Not to mention black freedom. So the things that Donald Trump has stood for example, killing Obamacare and being opposed to insurance coverage for people with pre-existing conditions, those kinds of things are anathema to a candidate in the state of Florida. Given the age of our population, given the number of retirees we have here, health care is a major issue, and it's a big problem for DeSantis to address that. Gillum has no problem addressing because we know what he wants to do. People can question whether he'll ever get the money to do it or whether the Republican-controlled legislature will cooperate with him, but his agenda on health care is very clear. So on that issue alone, the main issue in the state of Florida, DeSantis is at a disadvantage because of his association philosophically and politically and even emotionally with Donald Trump. So I thought that, and again, I watched it with a certain degree of bias, but I tried to view it as balanced as I could. But I clearly felt that Mr. DeSantis lost both of those debates, and that Mr. Gillum won them fair and square.
Did our current president, Mr. Trump, because you said DeSantis, and I would agree, I've read multiple reports, I don't think this is just you, many observers of the Florida race, and this has become a big national deal, have said that Ron DeSantis is pretty much in lockstep with Donald Trump. He pretty much agrees with all of his policies and everything that he can to support Trump. Just, I'm going to ride his coattails to the governor's house.
That was a problem. That was a problem between DeSantis and Trump. Just to catch you up on that, you remember when Trump claimed that only a few hundred people died in that hurricane in Puerto Rico?
Oh, right.
We knew that actually several thousand people died. Well, that caught DeSantis in a bind because there were a lot of Puerto Rican voters in Florida who were offended by Trump's downplaying, minimizing the deaths in that event. And Ron DeSantis came out and publicly disagreed with Trump on that. And Trump disavowed him at that point, said he was not going to come to Florida to help DeSantis. Parenthetically, he was in Florida today campaigning for DeSantis. But he felt that DeSantis was disloyal to him because he did not toe the line on the question of the number of people who died in the hurricane in Puerto Rico. So they have been at somewhat odds in the last several months. But Mr. Trump realizes that Florida is critical to his reelection hopes for 2020. He must have Florida. He can't afford to ignore the governor's race in Florida. So he's here. They've made up. But DeSantis did take issue with Trump on the question of the number of deaths in Puerto Rico from the hurricane.
Absolutely. I think the report that I read were several where they said that these folks, Mr. DeSantis and President Trump, together in alignment. They had two issues where they agreed. That was one that was listed, but pretty much everything else, DeSantis has been absolutely on the party line. But
correct.
There was one thing specifically with this. Did Trump win the state of Florida? Did he get those 29 electoral votes in 2016?
Yes.
That's why I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful, but I'm still a little suspicious because I've seen this pattern before where it looks like whites are not going to go with the Trump. Like, it's no way. And then they do. Like, with
your caution is well deserved. I don't wish to be overconfident. I don't talk here locally about my comfort level with what's going to happen, because I would not want voters to believe that this thing is in the bag. So you're right to be to have reservations about this, and you're right about white people who you think were going to vote one way, and when they get in the voting booth or fill out their ballots, they vote quite a different way. But it's a different chemistry in the country right now. There's a different chemistry in Florida right now. It's toxic. It's savage. It is as brutally racist as I've seen it in my lifetime. And then beyond that, it's divided in terms of class, economic conflict in our state. So this is not the same Florida that Trump won when he ran for president the first time around. We have been, I think, savaged by the Trump presidency, and I think whites in Florida have been among the victims of this presidency. And we go back to my original point about health care being the main injury to Floridians as a result of the Trump administration.
If you could give us like explicit detail on that, you said where whites have been victims of this.
Yes, yes. Consider now, Florida is a retirement state.
Mm-hmm.
We have an older population in Florida than you'll find in other states in the union. We have a retirement community, we have major retirement communities, particularly in Central Florida. And in South Florida, we have an aging population in Florida, and these folks have health issues. They have pre-existing conditions that the attempts to kill Obamacare placed those health coverages in great jeopardy. People lost the comfort of knowing that their health coverage was going to be there as they aged even more so. So health care in Florida is a more potent issue than it is even in the country. And right now it seems to be the main issue in the country itself. And that touches on all races in Florida, not just black people. It's an issue even with the Hispanic community, where we have an aging Hispanic community here. Not to diminish the fact that we have a Republican Cuban-American segment that's very strong in South Florida in particular. But if you look at the Hispanic population across the state of Florida, you'll also see the same issue of health care, education, advanced age of the population, and concern about the almost predictable thing that will happen if the Republicans win the midterms, and that is that Medicare and Social Security will be cut. Mitch McConnell, the president of the Senate, has told us that. The minority leader of the Senate has told the country. It sort of slipped out a couple of weeks ago. They intend to cut back on Medicare and Social Security. They see themselves as having to do that because the deficit is climbing. Trickle-down economics didn't work. They thought that by giving the big businesses the huge tax cut that they got, that money would pump back into the government still, and that has not happened. So we just had our Treasury Department yesterday announce that it has to borrow $1.2 trillion, the highest debt that we've ever had in our nation at a time when Republicans are supposed to be bringing down the deficit. So their economic plan has not worked. The attempt to kill Obamacare has backfired on them. And then you have the racism and now with the event in Pittsburgh, the concern about religious freedom in our country that has now moved to the top of the agenda in terms of the immediate election that we're facing right now. So it's not the same as it was when Trump got elected. It's a much different country, a much different state, and that's one of the reasons I believe that a lot of folks are going to change, particularly people who were independent and moderate. About 14% of the voting population in Florida are independents, and the percentage of independent registered voters is growing in Florida. So that gives me reasonable, and that's the group that Trump is losing. Those kinds of dynamics give me reason to believe that we'll see a different result this time around.
Context of white supremacy, particularly our listeners in the Florida area. Give us a ring if you want to share a thought, who you think is going to win, if you think things have changed that drastically in the 2 years that Trump has been in the White House in the Sunshine State. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-940#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I wanted to follow up on your response, Dr. Dunn. The point about whites being victims with things like health care being cut, and I think during the most recent debate, Mr. DeSantis, it's almost like bragging about how many times he voted to repeal what is called Obamacare, and he's not the only one. I mean, many whites seem to take pride in this, how many times they've tried to get this repealed or how much they hate this policy. But I think there's a long pattern, and in fact, there are books written about this, where whites will be injurious to themselves as long as it is more injurious to black people, especially non-white people in total. And there are examples. In fact, there's a white person who's written a whole book about how we have really horrible welfare in this country because whites would rather have a system that even does not take care adequately of white people as long as black people are also not being taken care of. They would rather have that as opposed to a system that takes care of white people correctly, but that means it's also going to take care of black people correctly. They do not want that at all and would rather be, hey, we'll just have it be messed up for everyone. And there are multiple examples of this. The Port Chicago Mutiny, there was an explosion, World War II, off the coast in California. Racism was at the root of this. We talked about this back in 2010. Racism was at the root of
why this. Yes, they killed a lot of black sailors with that event.
Exactly. Talking to a historian, the damage happened to a lot of residents on the coastline in this explosion. When it came time to compensate, it was, okay, are we going to compensate everybody correctly, which would mean we got to compensate the niggers correctly, or are we going to shaft everybody? And they chose the latter. And I've seen that too many times where it's whites, they are not going to want to fund, and especially what they call an increasingly browning nation, so-called, where it's...
You're right. You're absolutely on point. But you know what the problem with that is that I don't want to be overgeneralized here, but I think most white people believe that most of the people on welfare are black or brown. That's the misperception. Most of the folks who are on welfare, let me just take my county, Miami-Dade County, are not black. They are Hispanic and white. And I think this tends to be the case across a great part of the country, where you have a majority of white people receiving public benefits, but that fact seems to be invisible to whites who see the black welfare cheaters, the black women having babies out of wedlock as a way of bilking the state and the federal government. So there's a misperception about where public assistance goes. And if you look at what happens with public assistance in housing, health care, support to children, the majority of public support goes to people who are white. Most of the people in this country who accept public assistance are white people.
That is true. I think, at least my view, I suspect that most whites, they're aware of that. I think they just practice racism by promoting that lie just to, you know, brand black people as exactly what you said, lazy, cheats, they don't want to work, and they just want to live off the dole. I think they just practice racism.
Straight out of slavery.
Exactly.
It reaches all the way back to slavery, where white people perceive blacks as lazy. They won't work unless you make them work. Mm. They prefer to take a handout rather than earn something. It's amazing. I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm sorry, but the historical residue of slavery has been translated into our modern culture in ways that people don't recognize. And you just put your finger on one of those, and that is a perception that black people would rather be given things by white people than earn them on their own.
Absolutely. The other point, and this was a key, I guess, topic that I wanted to address. I even heard this early this morning. I was doing my AM yoga, as I always do, and a black female, she said that she felt things have changed. She said exactly what you just said. Things have changed. It's such a different climate with Donald Trump that this is allowing for things like what happened with the synagogue shooting. She did not mention the shooter in Kentucky last week who killed two black people went to a black church beforehand. And like the pipe bomber who was arrested in Florida, it's allowing for things like this to happen. And I stopped. Savagery, that was the word that you used. It's become more savage.
Yeah.
2 years of Trump in the White House. And I don't think that that's accurate. I'm talking to a historian, and I grab Exhibit A. I grab The Beast in Florida, A History of Anti-Black Violence. Okay. And I look at everything that's happening right now, and I say, Cesar Sayoc, apologies if I mispronounced. I look at him, and then I look back at Dr. Harry T. Moore. I look at everything that's happening right now. Andrew Gillum, yes, he's running for governor. All of the terrorism that's happening, the language that's being used to talk about black people or to talk about, you know, we don't want this caravan of invaders coming into our state to rape and pillage. That's the exact same way that I've heard black people talk about Mac Charles Parker, many other incidents right in the state. That's been the whole history of black people. And I keep looking at this. And
You're right.
Oh,
I can't argue.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, but let me. I got one disclaimer though.
Yes, sir.
Listen now carefully. Donald Trump is unique as a president of the United States. He is a unique president. We have never had a person abuse presidential power in the way that this man has in just 2 years. This has never happened to us as a country before. And a lot of folks are scared, not just black people. A lot of people are frightened by what has happened to our country. So I want to agree with you about, if you go back and look at the things I mentioned in my book and document it, you're quite right. The trail of racism, of white supremacy, is endemic in Florida. It is. I can name more cases than I documented in that book. So you're quite correct about that. But I do want to make the point that in the modern era, in the Obama period and now into this current president, there were changes in the country. For those 8 years of Obama, we were hopeful. We didn't have this kind of poison. We were not saturated with hatred and the sort of negative speech that we hear coming out of the White House and out of many people in Congress. So I think it's a special historical moment that we're going through. But that is not to disagree with your basic point that racism, white racism in Florida and in the country is alive and well. It may be being expressed in different ways. We don't have people lynched as much or as often as we have had in the past era. But we should not be deluded in thinking that black people are safe. You know, I was out campaigning just on the – I take my Gillum signs out and park along a busy street here at rush hour time. Just did that a couple of hours ago before I came in. You know what happens when some white people drive? I'm just standing by myself with my signs just sort of waving at traffic. When the traffic slows down and the car stops right where I am, the white folks let their windows up. What is that? Like I'm going to jump in the car? I'm trying to get this man elected, and I see the black folk let the windows down and yell, "Hey, Dr. Nunn!" And I don't mean to overgeneralize. A lot of white people honk and wave, too. But it doesn't take but a few people doing that to make you realize that a lot of white folks are afraid of me. I'm a 7-8-year-old man. What the hell they got to be afraid of me for?
Wow.
Put the damn windows up. I'm just trying to get a man elected to governor. Y'all letting the damn windows up.
If that's how they're responding,
don't get me started now.
If that's how they're responding to you, a 78-year-old with a doctorate, although uppity, I just say, wow. Mr. Gillum, Mr. Gillum is young and virile and handsome, as you said. Like, oh my! Like, I don't know. I might have to put a few wager on Mr. DeSantis. But one point that I did want to get in, I thought one point I think is so important. The reason that I think it's accurate and it's significant that it not be said that this environment is so different and the racism that's being expressed now is somehow different. One, because there is such a long history of anti-black violence and white terrorism, not just in the state of Florida, but in the entire world. There's such a long history of that. And even with the rhetoric,
correct.
I do. And I'm in Washington State, so I'm in a totally different part of the world than you are. But even when President Obama was in office, I remember whites in Congress yelling, "You lie." I remember little children on the bus in Oregon chanting, "Assassinate the president." Carol Anderson's book, where she documents, it was an unprecedented rise in death threats against the president. And they had documented it was an unprecedented rise in hate groups and hate activity during those 8 years in office, which is what I'm saying. I don't see when people talk about it's like, wait a minute, did you all just watch President? What did he say? Muslim N-I-G-G-E-R. That's what I watched for 8 years. I didn't see 8 years of hope. I saw the same thing that Dr. Frances Cress Welsing saw, because you talked about being surprised about Trump being elected. Before her passing, she was not. Dr. Welsing saw the same thing that I'm talking about, and she said, oh yeah, Trump is going to be president. She said that in 2015. I also was among the minority who was not shocked, who said, what did I just watch for 8 years? It was not hope. It was white people yelling, get that nigga out of the White House. That was the overwhelming sentiment that I saw.
You and I agree on more things than might be apparent. The election of Barack Obama seized the greatest fears of white supremacists in the country. What a nigga got elected to the White House? You got niggas sleeping in the... They couldn't believe it. So it energized white racism in this country at a level that had not happened, I think, before the Obama era. So there was a reaction to it that led to Trumpism. So there's a connectivity here that I agree that you're correct. I'll only say, though, that remember, Obama could not have been elected by just black people. We could not, if every black person in the country had voted for Barack, he would not, and only us, he would not be president. He got support from whites, and that's how he became president. But you're correct about the fact that hope vanished very quickly, and this rise in resistance to black aspirations evolved in the aftermath of the success of the Obama presidency.
Context of White Supremacy author and historian Dr. Marvin Dunn. It's not that I forgot, I've been mentioning him, but also think it's important right in the state of Florida, and it's right connected to the governor. It's connected to everything we've been talking about, even though his name has been said, Mr. Cesar Sayoc. Everything we've been talking about. Upset. I don't know if he was upset about President Obama. I haven't seen any reports about that specifically, but certainly people saying that he was a Trump supporter. They have photographs of him where he was apparently at a number of Trump events with signs and what have you. Very proud. Lots of rhetoric against black people. The pipe bombs that he sent out. I highlighted the disproportionate number of black people that were male devices.
That's right.
Obama's, Maxine Waters. U.S. Senator Cory Booker, former Attorney General Eric Holder, a highly disproportionate number of black people targeted.
Kamala Harris, yes, you're right.
Oh, that's right. I forgot. Senator as well. Mm-hmm. With this guy and him being arrested, taken into custody without being harmed, I might add, doesn't happen to a lot of unarmed black people frequently who have not mailed pipe bombs. This individual, and he even got eclipsed because I haven't heard as much attention focused on him since the synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh. That's kind of taken the bulk of the media attention on all of this. The first
the first question that I wanted to ask with Mr. Sayoc, I heard Bill Cosby, within hours of him being sentenced, I heard him referred to as a terrorist multiple times. I have not heard Mr. Sayoc regularly referred to as a suspected terrorist, even as a domestic terrorist. Have you heard him being referenced as a terrorist, suspected terrorist?
Once or twice. He fits the bill perfectly of a domestic terrorist. There's a view that in order to be a terrorist, one must be from the Middle East. One must be from outside of this country. That's a very delimiting definition of a terrorist. I think the terrorists that we need to be concerned about in America live among us. And this guy is just one example, as well as the man who went into that temple and shot those people. The most dangerous are you there?
Oh, yes, sir. We can hear you. The most dangerous.
Maybe someone was trying to call in on this line. I was trying to make the point that I think Americans face far more danger in terms of terrorism from people right here in our own country than we do from people who come into the country to commit terrorist acts.
They had last summer, they had an FBI report about black identity extremists, and they cited a number of different cases where a single black person had allegedly attacked law enforcement, and they said that this was something that we should be paying attention to see if there could be a rise in this type of activity. It seems like there has been a lot of whites who have gone out to do these type of shootings or some sort of violent activity, frequently stating explicitly that this is about racism, white supremacy. The Mr. Sayoc, the shooter in Kentucky, have you seen the same sort of response to say, hey, domestic terrorism and specifically white males, we should be on alert. They're causing a lot of problems.
No, what you're seeing is massive denial. The refusal to accept the fact that a white man, white American male, could be defined as a terrorist. There's a reticence to do that. People are much more comfortable defining terrorists as being from the Middle East. There's a rush to do that when it comes to blacks. Remember the Black Panthers, how they went after them as defined as terrorists? There's no hesitancy to accuse organized black resistance as terrorists and to stick the FBI on them or other kinds of ways of seeking them out and punishing them. But you're quite correct in noting that there is a hesitation to describe these people as terrorists, and that's precisely what they are. We're suffering from the hands of homegrown terrorists, and there are a lot more of them out there. And as a psychologist, I must say the likelihood of a copycat or copycats emerging in this era, particularly if the midterm election goes bad for the Republicans, I think we face the possibility of even more of these acts being perpetrated by white males in the post-midterm period.
So by just making sure I understand you correctly, you say by the midterms going bad. So if you're correct, Mr. Gillum wins, he first black governor of the state of Florida, you think there could be more Mr. Sayoc, more white males committing flagrant public white terrorism?
The first thing that would need to happen if Andrew gets elected is they need to triple the number of state troopers that protect the governor. I think that if the Republicans lose badly in the midterms, that this will possibly set off rage among people who are borderline crazy to begin with, who will not be able to tolerate the loss of Republican power. And I think that they will not take this sitting down. I think a few of these people will be moved to the point of showing their rage by attacking people of color and other so-called soft targets in our society. I'm very concerned about that. I'd be happy to see a midterm sweep where Democrats regain at least some power in this country. I would love to see Andrew Gillum elected governor of Florida, but there's a risk that goes along with this, and it is that it will stir up these sick, dangerous people who will be moved to act in ways that will surely be very dangerous, especially to very high profile black people like Cory Booker, like Kamala, like the folks who were targeted by this man with these pipe bombs.
You're right next door to Georgia. It could be history all the way around in Southeast U.S. with Miss Abrams if she becomes first black female governor in Georgia. And you seem super confident that Mr. Gillum is going to be victorious in Florida. So you're saying you think do you think Miss Abrams, do you think she'll win in Georgia?
I'm a little bit less comfortable about that. The margin of lead that Gillum has in Florida is not matched by the governor in the race for governor by Stacey. So it's a closer race. Then you have the problem that the Secretary of State, who controls the election, is her opponent, and the election is so close that there's almost certainly going to be a recount, and she's going to have her opponent in charge of the recount. So there's a situation in Georgia that is extremely sensitive and very difficult to predict in terms of that race. I've only seen one poll where they were within one point of each other. Oh, that's bad for the Republicans, for a Democrat to be that close, less a black woman. But Gillum has a more comfortable lead in Florida than she does in Georgia. Plus, as I mentioned, her opponent is going to be the one who gets to count the votes for the recount.
Wow. We have a lot of listeners in the Georgia area as well. We'll be keeping an eye on what happens there. There was an audio segment where they were giving more details about what they suspect could happen with the Sayoc case, and even talking about this is a white male who had a history of arrests and problems with enforcement officials. In fact, they said he had violated the conditions of his parole like multiple times. Like he perhaps should have even been in public circulation. Maybe he should have been in greater confinement before he even got an opportunity to engage in any of this terrorist activity. This is a report. It's given just a little bit more detail. Just be attentive to the words that are used. We'll be right back. Dr. Marvin Dunn, this is the context of white supremacy.
This morning we've been talking about the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue, but this past week also saw 14 package bombs sent to prominent Democrats and critics of President Trump. A man has been arrested in that case. Cesar Sayoc is being held at the Federal Detention Center in Miami. For the latest on this story, we turn now to NPR's national security correspondent Greg Myrie, who is in neighboring Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning.
Good morning, Lulu.
All right. So he's been arrested. What should we be looking for on the legal front?
Well, we expect Sayoc to go before a federal magistrate Monday here in Miami. It's probably going to be a very brief appearance, though he may enter a plea for these five federal charges he faces. And then we expect that he will be sent to New York, perhaps fairly soon. New York will be taking the lead in the prosecution here.
Are there any new details on the investigation?
Well, there have been no new explosives in the mail since Friday when he was arrested. So that's perhaps the most important point. Still the question, how did one person living out of his van with no resources make all these explosives and put the nation on edge? CNN has reported, citing a source, that he apparently was making them in his van, and there's no sign he had any other help.
Are we getting a picture of how he became this extreme?
Yeah, there was this dramatic shift in 2016. He had a very troubled life, lots of arrests, but he wasn't political. He, on social media, where he was very prolific, it was about things like soccer and bodybuilding and nightlife. And then 2 years ago, all this anger, political anger, starts coming out in social media. One thing really struck me. He, as we know, lived in a van. He hung out sort of on the southern edge of Fort Lauderdale. In part Parkland, the community that had that horrific school shooting this year. That's only about 15 miles away, sort of the northwest edge of Fort Lauderdale. And Sayoc began making all these attacks against David Hogg, one of the students who survived and became a prominent gun control advocate. He was constantly going after Hogg on Twitter, saying he was a fraud, he didn't go to the school, and then, in fact, he was an actor being paid by George Soros, the financier who's been in the news so much lately. And Soros, in fact, was the first to receive an explosive package in the mail.
I understand you've spoken with coworkers, including one who was in that van.
Yeah, Deborah Garagian was a manager at the New River Pizza, where Sayoc was a delivery driver. And she says they got along. He was reliable. He gave her a ride home one night when it was raining. And she noticed all these dirty clothes and food wrappers. But she said he also openly talked about saying that gays and Jews and blacks should be eliminated. Here's what she said about his political thinking.
We would start talking about Hitler. He loved Hitler. Loved Hitler. And we should go back to that society with Hitler.
That's NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lulu.
Dr. Francis Kress Welsing encouraged us to study Nazi Germany, the influence of Adolf Hitler. What I thought was pretty much every segment that I've heard about Mr. Sayoc has been fascinating. What really stood out to me in that segment was that they found this coworker who can say, oh, he was great. He gave me a ride home. He was a nice fella. Loved Hitler. Talked about how blacks should be killed all the time, but he was an all right guy. That sort of normalization of white terrorism, where you can even be in a work environment and present those sort of views and you remain employed, much less an employee in what sounds like good standing. Did anything stand? One, you can let me know if I'm talking crazy, Dr. Dunn. And then two, did anything stand out from the segment?
Well, the ease with which it's possible for people like this to hide, I think people kind of expect someone who would do an act, who would commit an act like that, to be a raving maniac, that we would see signs of it ahead of the event, that we should be able to red flag someone who would go into a school and shoot and kill kids, or who would go into a synagogue and kill people. That's a myth. It's very easy to hide this level of sickness. What?
I'm sorry for interrupting. I was just thinking he worked at a restaurant. Like, did black people eat there? I apologize.
Well, they probably spit in their food if they did. I'm not being ridiculous in saying that. But back to my point about how there's an expectation that crazy should be visible. And as a psychologist, I can tell you, crazy is not normally visible, at least not this kind of crazy. Yes, schizophrenia is visible. We know folks who are suffering from certain kinds of mental disease. But the kind of rage, the kind of racism, the kind of mentality that this man has, both men who in these incidents we're focusing on, they don't show that they're dangerous. And even the glimpses of them that we get that would suggest that they are dangerous tend to be dismissed, particularly if they're white, and behaving in other ways that appear to be normal. So that is one of the reasons that I'm particularly concerned about copycats emerging, about the likelihood, if the Republicans lose the power significantly next week, that we will see more of these people who have hidden themselves quite effectively in our society emerge and do horrible things.
Wow. I guess the view that I want to make sure that I get across to listeners on this is, number one, I keep mentioning her name, Dr. Frances Kress Welsing. She spent time with us in 2012, and she talked about in racial matters, she was a general and child psychiatrist. She talked about not using the term crazy in racial matters, because in her view, if someone classified as white, if they make up their mind that they want to practice racism, that's not them being crazy. And I think with Mr. Sayoc, I don't know if he was crazy. It seems like someone who believed in racism, white supremacy. And I think it's that I don't think he was hiding. Like when they said in the clip, that he was telling his views to his coworkers. Like, he had all those bumper stickers on his van. He was at the rallies. I don't think he was hiding at all. And I think if I was to connect it, it's what I've been saying about I don't think things are substantially different. I don't think things have changed. I don't think it's that he was hiding. I don't think Dylann Roof was hiding. They said that he made his views, his racist views, known pretty normally, regularly. I don't think it's that these individuals are hiding. I think it's that racism, white supremacy, and particularly violence against black people. If you want to articulate racist views, especially anti-black views, that is totally acceptable. That is not crazy. That's nothing to report. That is par for the course, and in fact, even encouraged anytime, not just now, but anytime in the system of racism, white supremacy. I think that's why these individuals, Dylann Roof, as I said, even Jeffrey Dahmer in Wisconsin, who was mostly targeting black males, non-white males in Wisconsin. And we had one of his biographers on the program who said perhaps that's why he was able to go undetected for so long. Not that he was crazy, but we don't care about black people. Who cares? Someone wants to butcher.
Let me qualify what I meant. But what I meant by crazy, What I meant by crazy is each of the individuals you just named exhibited a total disregard for human life. That's crazy. That's what makes them uniquely different from just a racist who would never actually take a gun and shoot somebody because they're black. But when a person crosses the line and dismisses the value of human life, much less takes it upon himself or herself to take human life based upon their racist or religious views, that is my definition of crazy in this context.
I see. I guess the only thing I would say, my definition of racism, white supremacy, the entire white collective, they have devalued the life of everyone classified as black. That's what I said. That's par for the course. And that's why, that's the staggeringness of it. I didn't even really process. Mr. Sayoc worked at a pizza restaurant. I'm sure some non-white people ate there. I'm sure people who are concerned say they're LGBT. I'm sure some gay people ate there. I'm sure some Jewish people ate there or ordered. And they said he delivered too, ordered pizza from them. This white woman who rode with him and heard that he loved Hitler, she didn't think, oh, wait a minute, maybe you shouldn't be working at a restaurant. You'd probably be spitting in the black people's food or the Jewish people's food or the gay. Maybe that wasn't her thought process. That's what I mean about it's not crazy, because that's just what the white collective supports. He wasn't fired. He wasn't unemployed. If you were a black person, if it had been me or you being uppity on the job talking bad about white people, you would have been fired. I would have been fired. She would have been on there talking about what a, you know, swell fella that we were, even though you were, you know, on there. I don't even know who the comparison would be for Hitler. I don't know. Louis Farrakhan. I don't even know. That's not even an accurate comparison. But
It is not.
Yeah, I don't even know who you could quote. But I mean, that's what I mean. The system of racism, white supremacy, it nourishes and encourages. That's why you can have such a continuum, whether it's Dr. Harry T. Moore, Dylann Roof, it's going to continue. That is supposed to continue in this system in a myriad of different ways. Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
Yes, it does. Absolutely. Absolutely. I would add, though, that most white racists wouldn't kill. We would be in terrible shape if that was the case. People can live with their racism, practice their racism, even overtly, speak it out loud, and still not cross that line where they feel compelled and justified to take a human life based upon their racist feelings. Most racists are restrained behind that line. Now, circumstances can change in a society where more people feel that it's appropriate and even necessary to do that. And as you look at the browning of America, I don't have a lot of trouble seeing more people who are white, who are racist, moving across that divide that I have given to you as my definition of crazy. People who feel threatened, surrounded, who feel that the world as they knew it is being lost, can feel that in order to save themselves and their fellow whites, that they have to take action that would end up with the lives of black people or Jewish people or some other minority being taken to make their own psychic fit their sense of reality.
Context of white supremacy. The number again, if folks have a question for Dr. Marvin Dunn, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you have a question you would like to ask, particularly if we have any of the folks who are residents in the great state of Florida. If you've been watching the debate, if you have a thought about who's going to win the debate based on, you know, what you've seen, your own assessment, I would be delighted to hear your thoughts. Let's see. While I'm checking to see if other folks have a question, the Stand Your Ground case, Marquise McLaughlin, this is the black male from just a few weeks back. He was shot and killed out in the parking lot. It was a white male. He had a firearm on him. That was a dispute about a parking space. And this is once again brought up the Stand Your Ground law in the state of Florida. I don't think this case has got as much attention as certainly not as much as Trayvon Martin the last time that this issue came up. But have you been following this case? Do you have any thoughts or whether?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Okay.
Oh, yes, indeed. It was bizarre that this man, this black man, was shot as he was backing away from the this white man who hid behind this ridiculous law that we have in Florida, the Stand Your Ground law. Somehow or another, I guess, because if you look at the tape of that event, there was an encounter between the two men in which the black man showed some aggression toward this white person. And once that happens, in the minds of a lot of people, to do harm, even to go beyond the necessary violence to respond to the encounter, the fact that the black man showed aggression toward a white person in a way sort of changes the whole script. The man then, the black man then deserved what he got. And you have to keep in mind, I don't want to overstate this, but I think I'm comfortable in saying it. In general, many, many, many white people are afraid of black people, particularly of black men, particularly of young black men. This is a phenomenon that is prevalent across our country. So if there's some exchange of words that moves beyond that into some physical encounter, the black person is going to be seen as the aggressor, as deserving what he got. And I think the courts have sort of recognized that. But we see this certainly translated in the cases where we have white police officers shooting black males. You would have a totally different dynamic if it was a white officer shooting a white person. There is a fear of black males that has been endemic in American society since the first slave ship arrived. You got to keep in mind that the men who were brought to this country initially as slaves were not weaklings. They didn't go to Africa and get the weakest, sickest guys that they could find. They've got the biggest, strongest, youngest black men they could capture or buy and brought them into a white society in the South. And what does that do? It sets up a dynamic for black men to be seen as dangerous, as animals, as apes, as having to be kept in check by white power and white violence if necessary. I don't think that particular psychic has changed all that much in our society today. It's a throwback all the way back to the arrival of the first black men into white society in this country.
Mm. What's your response to those who say, hey, Dr. Dunn, I don't think that white people are scared of black people at all, that white man who killed Mr. McLaughlin, that he was not afraid, that he just wanted to shoot a black person, that I don't think when Trayvon Martin was shot and killed, that was not fear. That was just, hey, I want to kill a black person. I got my gun. Bang, that they just used that fear as an excuse to justify.
It might have been hustler too. It may not necessarily have been just one thing. Mm. You may be quite right about that. It may have been beyond just fear, but to the point of how dare him? Hmm. How dare you, as a black person, have the nerve to show any sign of any degree of aggression towards me as a white person? So you're distilling it down to that possible element being involved is, I think, appropriate as well.
Hmm. As I said, I think with that case, I don't think it got as much attention from putting that sort of historical lens on it, where this was a black male who had the audacity, the camera shows he's aggressive, to shove a white person. Do you think he's good? Same thing is going to happen? Do you think it's likely that he's going to be exonerated?
Well, I think initially he was exonerated, and I think there was such public pressure that the authorities took steps to try to hold him accountable at some level for what he did. But it doesn't remove the fact that initially there is this view that it's justified to show aggressive action, even to kill a black male who has the nerve to exhibit any degree of aggression towards a white person. That's something that we live with. If a person, a white person, considers himself or herself to be not racist or to be a fair-minded person, let them meet a black young male on the street at night, meeting them, and see what kind of reaction they'll have. If they'll cross the other side of the street or hold the purse closer to the body or expect some affront from a black person, even people who think that they are beyond these kinds of feelings. We have a long way to go to remove this racist poison from our society, even among people who think that they are beyond it.
Hmm. I wanted to make sure I took advantage of the opportunity having a historian with us. There was a claim made in one of the books that we read in our recent book study, and I wanted to ask to see if you think that this is true. So they're talking about the biggest obstacle to black liberation. And the statement, it reads, the black male who breeds with the white female represents the single biggest threat to black liberation. Do you think that is a true statement, Dr. Dunn?
I'm not sure I agree with that. I can agree with that. I think what we are seeing, particularly in the last 30, 40 years, since the 1960s anyway, since significant integration or desegregation has occurred in the workplace, in schools and universities across the country, we're seeing a spike in interracial relationships that end in sexual encounters or marriage even. And if you consider the fact that the number of available productive black men, educated black men in our society is small. And there's a sense, particularly I think among many black females, that when black men go and marry white women, that they are now working against the aspirations of blacks in general. And I understand that. It's a reality. But we pushed to go to the same schools as white people. We pushed to be on the same jobs as white people. And interracial relationships were and are inevitable in light of these changes in our society. So I don't think that's the biggest threat to black liberation. I think the biggest threat to black liberation is the number of black children who are being reared with the absence of black fathers, or black males having a prominence in their lives. Of course, there are a lot of reasons for that. But my current work, as a matter of fact, is with most of my clients are black men on death row in Florida. Either they're on death row or they're heading to death row. They've committed capital murder. And my role as a psychologist is to try to find a basis, psychological basis, for the state not to execute these men, notwithstanding the fact that the way in which the laws are applied, the black males are much more likely to get the death penalty than our white men. But as I've met with my 35 or 40 or so clients over the last 10 years on death row or in the jails heading to death row, I have found that this is a pernicious issue where we have so many black men in prison, in, not necessarily on death row, but in jail, based upon racist activities by police officers to arrest black young men for trivial matters that ruins a black young man's life. He has a record that sets him off on a path of even more criminal activity because of what happens if you have a record. So I'm very concerned about the dilution of the black breeding population, because so many black men are not available because they are in jail, in prison, and are not likely to come back and be able to sustain and support their families. That, to me, is the biggest threat that we face. We have got to find a way to sustain the black family in the reality and of the absence of so many black men in the presence of their children. If we can somehow or another manage to reorganize the black family, where the black female has more support and help, where black men in particular are more available as mentors, even temporarily involved in the lives of black boys especially, I am much more concerned about that as being the greatest threat to black aspirations in our society.
Hmm. You are a bit older than I am, Dr. Dunn, and I know for me, seeing Bill Cosby, speaking of black males in greater confinement, it has been traumatizing, and I was not necessarily a fan of Bill Cosby, entertainer, or his political views, but it has been traumatizing. I was just saying the other day that I was at yoga class again, and a non-white female went to hug me, and I kind of moved back like, whoa, like, let's watch all the physical contact. Like, what? Mm-hmm. Just seeing the entire arc of his career and talking about integration. He was I Spy, Bill Cosby, one of the first on television.
Yes.
Prime time, all of that. What has been your experience being an older black male seeing the demise of Bill Cosby?
Well, I was a Cosby fan. I admired Bill. From the I Spy series all the way through this television series, I thought that he was doing a marvelous job of repositioning white society's view of black men. The whole family that was, you know, that was portrayed in The Cosby Show did a great service to the country and to black people. So his fall, his demise was more painful for that very reason, because he carried so much on his shoulders through his career that made so many of us love him and respect him and want to emulate him, that his demise was just a tragedy, a personal tragedy, of course, for him, not to mention his victims. So I didn't have any sympathy for him, given the weight of charges against him, given how consistent and persistent the behavior was in terms of his attacks on women. So I had to deal with my initial impressions of Bill Cosby and my current impression of him. But I would rush to add that you have extremely wealthy white men who were in the public eye, who have been charged with assaulting women, who are not in prison and should be. So why is Bill in prison, and a lot of guys, I won't name names, I'm sure your audience are aware of some of these men, why are they not also in jail? So I think there's a certain element of racism in the Cosby case that cannot be escaped, that goes beyond just the fact that that Cosby was a rich man, as are these other white males that I'm talking about at the moment. But why is Cosby in jail and so many others who have done equally injurious things to women still free and functioning in society as if they hadn't done anything?
I won't name names, but I will say at least one of the white men accused of sexual misconduct, not only did he not end up in greater confinement, he got to relocate to the White House. Great minds.
I knew you were going to go there.
It's great minds.
I knew you were going to go there. And isn't that interesting how white America was able to shut its eyes to this most egregious sick behavior on the part of Donald Trump, dismiss it as if boys will be boys was the rationale we heard at the time, and then allow this man, who is a sexual predator, to ascend to the White House and be the leader of the free world. It is mind-boggling that this could have happened. And it did. And nobody's talking about it. It's as if, well, you know, it's just that's water downstream. It's not even being revisited. That we have someone who is leading our country who has been among the most dangerous characters to women, given what we know about Donald Trump's attitude about females.
And black people, his views on sexual misconduct in New York, the Central Park jogger case, speaking of raping black males, where these young black teens were falsely convicted of raping this white woman in the late 1980s. Mr. Trump, in the 80s, he took out that big ad, the Central Park Wilders, and we need to bring back the death penalty. We need to get more black males on death row as a result of this case. And then once they got the DNA scientific evidence that, nope, wasn't them, and in fact we got someone else who confessed to this, well, I still think they're guilty and they don't deserve any compensation. That was 2 years before he became president, commander-in-chief, that he was sticking to his... Go ahead.
Well, I was just completely agreeing with you. Trump's attitude towards blacks was mirrored in his attitude towards Jews. Someone interviewed him, and I think quoted accurately Trump having said at one point that he wouldn't let anybody count his money but a Jew, an elderly a Jewish man with a yarmulke on his head would be the only one that he would allow to handle his money. He didn't think black people could count, did not have the ability to be accountants. So this man, I don't believe those attitudes have changed, frankly. Grown men don't change their basic attitudes very much as we go through life. So we have someone who is, there's no surprise that that Nazis, neo-Nazis, Ku Kluxes, would find themselves in common company with Donald Trump. And I know America needs to move away from that perception of the president because he's in the White House and because we have a vision of a president as being above those kinds of things, but we have an outright racist person leading the free world. But not just racist attitudes, but attitudes that are very hostile and negative towards Jews. Even though his son-in-law is a Jew and his daughter is a converted Jew, his grandchildren are Jewish, this man's basic attitudes towards these minority groups, in my view, have not changed and will not change.
Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest joining us live from Florida, author, historian, Dr. Marvin Dunn. If listeners, if you have a question you would like to ask Dr. Dunn, especially our listeners in the Florida area, go ahead and get a hand up. Do not lollygag. We do not have Dr. Dunn for the entire evening. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I was flabbergasted when you were talking about your work on death row. Have you been able to, with your work, get any of the black males to stop them from being executed?
Yes. Not all. Some of my clients are still in at risk of being killed by the state of Florida. The what has resonated most often in the cases where I have been able to go in and testify before a jury or prepare a report for a judge to have him or her revisit a death sentence, the thing that seems to resonate most often in favor of my clients has been their early life, their family life, the fact that so many of them were abandoned, not just by their fathers, but also by their mothers. What we've seen happen, particularly since the 1980s and moving into the 90s and 2000s, is that we have an abandonment of children, not by the fathers, but by moms who've been lost to the street, lost to the pipe, lost to to the evils of society. And so their boys in particular grow up without the capacity to measure their behavior, to restrain their aggression, more inclined to drift towards gangs, drift towards illicit behavior, and therefore more likely to be arrested, and then possibly to have their behavior eventually result in killing somebody, and then being placed in jeopardy of losing their life for it. But when I can go into a courtroom and show, my very first client, as a matter of fact, that I was able to help save, was a black man who had killed his wife with a knife and then raped his stepdaughter, who had Down syndrome, tried to kill her. She lived. And then also attacked his stepson, who was also suffering from Down syndrome. And it was a horrendous murder. It just outraged the community as well it should have. So this man was seen as a pariah, someone certainly ought to be put to death, killing his wife, the bloody knife in his hand when the police finally broke into the house, the two children attacked by this man. It took me almost a year to get him to tell me his full story. And what had happened to him was that his mother was a crack addict in New York City when he was a little boy, from the time he was a baby, and his brother as well. And she would go from crack house, crash for days, be totally out of it with these two little boys. And he was raped several times when he was 5 and 6 years old. Never admitted it, tried to hide it, was ashamed of it. But eventually I was able to get him to tell me what had happened. And then we were able to substantiate this with his aunt. His mother passed away and others. And once that was made known, to the court, he was sentenced to his life. He was sentenced to life without any chance of getting out, but at least he was not killed. But it takes those kinds of extreme examples of black men who, as boys and young infants, had no mom present, much less no dad present, to help them navigate their lives in such a way as to avoid being sucked into crime, eventually even into deadly crime that could lead to them possibly losing their lives. So out of the 35 or so clients that I've had, I would say two-thirds of them fit that mold to a greater or lesser degree. So parental abandonment has been the main argument that I've been able to use to help some of these men not be killed.
Wow.
I spent a lot of time on death row. It's amazing, you know, and the guys seemed to relate to me as a father figure. It's someone who was not there in their real life. So, you know, here I am. I come to see them a dozen times. I'm with them 2 or 3 hours at a time, just the two of us in a room. No one's listening but just me. And they open up. And, you know, I find out the most fascinating things about these men. And you cannot escape the fact that they are black, haven't been part of the reason why they're on death row. But these psychosocial and economic factors also play into it. And what happens with a lot of my clients is that over time, they become so angry, so disregarding of human life, that they can do some very, very terrible things. I have 2 or 3 clients, and I had to ask them, you robbed the guy, he gave you his car, he gave you his money, he gave you his watch, why did you shoot him anyway? You know what I've been told in a few cases? He dissed me. He looked at me wrong. I had a gun on him, he still didn't respect me. So I shot him. So this tells you something about the psychic of some of these guys that has evolved to the fact that, to the point rather, that their own self-esteem is so low that the only way that they insist that they be respected is if they have a gun in their hand. And if you don't respect that, then they'll take you out.
Hmm. Well, I want to get the person who dialed in with a question. I just want to follow up on that. Before I went to sleep, the television was on yesterday, and they were talking about the former boxer, Marvin Hagler, and he changed his name to Marvelous, legally changed his name to Marvelous Marvin Hagler, because he felt he was not respected. And I mean, whew, man, think he did unfortunately have some time in greater confinement as well. Lots of black males with that experience of being abused, mistreated, said he felt isolated, said he, anyway, person who dialed in last four digits, 2161. You might be on the Skype line. If you had a question for Dr. Dunn, you should be with us.
Hey, greetings, Gus. This is Scotty from North Carolina. Greetings to you and Gus. Greetings to you, Gus, and Mr. Dunn as well, or Dr. Dunn. I just had two quick questions, one about racial violence and the second one about Mr. Gilliam's campaign. I'm sorry, did you say something?
No, I'm listening. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Sir, you're about my mom's age. You was born in the 50s. I was born in 1966. So, you know, I'm interested on your take on, just for example, in Charlotte, North Carolina, we had this racist white woman who was verbally, and some might interpret it as physical harassment, two black women. One of the black women lived at the apartment complex in question. She was having car trouble waiting on AAA. I don't know if you heard about that. And this white woman, inebriated, came up to them questioning if they lived there and bragged about how she was white and how she's beautiful and talking about the $125,000 a year that she make. I mean, it was just a blatant act of terrorism. Well, I read today that the Charlotte Mecklenburg police charged her with communicating a threat and simple assault. And also she had called 911 and lied, and they charged her with two counts of misuse of 911, which is a misdemeanor in North Carolina. Now, me growing up, coming to age, or, you know, becoming aware of my surroundings in the 70s, 80s, and thereafter, never in my life have I seen white people getting arrested, let alone charged, you know, and having to go to court to face charges of racial terrorism. What do you think has changed? Because I can't imagine that happened anytime during your youth.
Oh, no. No, not at all. You know, when I was coming up in the 40s and 50s, being insulted by a white person was expected. You had no right to take offense to being called a nigger, or to being dismissed, or to be cheated on your pay, and to have white anger tossed at you for even questioning the way that you were being treated. What has changed about that? Well, I think, in all fairness, the degree to which that happens has become less frequent. But I don't know of an instance in which a black person, black woman, has been arrested for the same sort of verbal assault against a white person. I'm not aware of those kinds of a case like that.
Okay, I am. But moving on, my next question is in reference to the Florida election. Also was referenced the 2016 election of Donald Trump, which was no surprise to me. And I expected him to win, especially when I found out who his opponent was going to be, which is the documented. Now, this isn't me saying she's a racist. There's evidence of Hillary Clinton being a racist. She's back in the news saying she can't tell the difference between these two prominent black men. All black people look alike. And I understand that she endorsed Mr. Gilliam down there. And some people saying that's like, you know, that's like the mark of the beast or something, that if you want to lose, if you want to energize, the other side is just have Hillary Clinton endorse you. So if the man does lose, I would suspect it's because she endorsed him and turned out the enemy. What are your thoughts on that? And I'll take the rest off. Listening to you later. Thank you.
Okay. It's a very good question. the endorsement of Hillary Clinton of Andrew Gillum was questionable, because Clinton has a lot of enemies in Florida, and the mere fact that Andrew allowed himself to be associated with her did cost him possibly with some people who do not like Hillary Clinton. But in that appearance that Hillary had with Andrew, in the time that she spent with him, she raised over $2 million for him. And that's not to be sneezed at. So they sort of cut both ways. She was able to come in and pump a couple of $1 million into the campaign. The folks who possibly had some problem with Andrew accepting help from Hillary may not have voted for him anyway. But you're correct to anticipate that the Clinton support, Hillary Clinton's support for Andrew, did cut both ways. It probably certainly energized some whites who hate Hillary so much that even if they weren't going to vote before, when Hillary came into the picture, it may have energized them to go out and be sure to vote against Andrew. Hello?
Much obliged, Mr. Reed, founder of the Black Talk Radio Network. Are you familiar, Dr. Dunn, are you familiar with Dr. Tommy Curry? He's at Texas A&M University. He has a book. It's called The Man Not, Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood. Have you heard of that book or Dr. Curry?
I have not.
Wow.
Given you're introducing him to me, I'll make sure that I Google him as soon as we hang up. I've not heard of him. Tell me, are you there?
Yes, sir. You said tell you.
Tell me just a little bit about what impresses you with his work. I'm going to look him up once we finish talking.
Well, he's been a guest on our program many, many times. His book, we're reading his book for our book club starting tomorrow. Tomorrow evening, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. But his book specifically is about Black misandry. And he has George Stinney on the cover of his book, the picture that was taken just before he was executed, 14-year-old in South Carolina, for listeners. And his book, it looks at the anti-Black male bias that is rife within the system of white supremacy and how that cannot be discussed. In his book, it focuses a lot on sexual violence against Black males and how that topic is not discussed within the academy at all. And the assumption is that if you are a victim of rape, it's female, that males cannot be victims of rape, and certainly Black males cannot be victims of rape, and how that gets overlooked and how that's been such a huge component of racism. So to overlook that is overlooking a huge component of what has been done to Black males. A lot of it looks at Black misandry and the unique vulnerability that Black males have within the system of white supremacy and how that's avoided. And just a huge chunk of our dialogue this evening, you talking about the response to you when you're out campaigning, you got your signs up and the white people come by and roll their windows up. You, a 78-year-old with a doctorate, no less, and published countless books. The response, the response that you were saying, just in general, whites being fearful of Black males in particular, and then your prison work. I mean, that is right in line, the sexual abuse, the abandonment with parents, the ice, all of it. I mean, that is really at the core of it. The Man Not, Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood. But I was going to tell him about your work, like, wow, he should really investigate, you know, what you're doing down in Florida. I'm sure he would love to include some of that in his study of Black males.
I'm going to investigate what he's doing as well. You know, one of the things that happened along the lines of that we're talking here, that has happened throughout history in our country and continues today, is that often when white women are involved in sexual relationships, let me go back to years back rather than just talk about the current situation, but we had a number of lynchings in Florida, and I think across the South, where Black men were lynched because they were having sex with a white woman. And it was consensual sex. But once the relationship was made public to white men, the white woman claimed that she was being raped or forced into the situation. Or we've had situations where white women have been involved in sexual relationships with white men. They get discovered, and they would claim that a black man somehow or another was involved in attacking them. In other words, the black male has been victimized by being falsely accused by white women of assaulting them, when in fact it's been consensual relationships. And in cases of white women who were discovered with black men, insisting that that they were there against their will. So it doesn't surprise me that this line of thinking is prominent in that book, and I intend to track it down and take a look at it. Very, very powerful stuff.
It is amazing scholarship. I had read it before. We had him on the program to talk about this book last summer. He brings up so many different points of things that are acutely, ways that the system acutely attacks black males, on the presumption that if you're a black male, you are violent, rapist, that you deserve some form of violence. It's necessary to keep black males like you, Mr. McLaughlin, to make sure that we keep people like you in check. We don't want, you know, black males just thinking that they can, you know, get uppity and riled up at a white person anytime that they want to over a parking space. We can't have that anywhere in the world, really.
But, you know, a lot of that comes out of slavery, when you had this great myth among white men that white women did not want black men. That white women saw black men as beasts, as apes, as being sexually abhorrent. When in fact, what I've found in my own research is that the extent of interracial relationships, even during slavery, went well beyond what was publicly acknowledged. But for white men who put white women on this pedestal as being pure and sanctified beyond being despoiled, unless by force, it was all a part of the myth, the sexual myth that white men in the South especially needed to convince themselves that white women did not want to be with black men. When in fact, the attractiveness of black males, even going back to slavery, was very prominent with white women, and many of them in girls, and many of them sought out black men at the peril of the black man losing his life and of the black woman being exiled from the community. So one of the things that I think has not been explored significantly, historically, has been this white male myth of white women rejecting black men sexually and seeing them as beasts and seeing them as dangerous to their beings, when in fact the amount of attraction to black males has been very prominent from the first slaves that were disembarked in Jamestown.
Interesting research. That is an area that has always sparked a lot of interest. So I'm sure if that book doesn't exist already, some folks have probably already got the wheels turning to crank that one out.
Well, you know what got me really interested in this is I was looking at lynchings. Mm-hmm. You know, I found cases in Florida where white men have been lynched. Not many, but there were some instances in white men were being lynched, usually for cattle rustling or murder, or killing a sheriff, or something like that. So we have some instances where that did happen. But I have yet to find one case in which a white male who was lynched was castrated. On the other hand, you find many instances of that happening to black men and boys. What is this business about attacking the genitals of black men and not those of white men who've committed equally egregious crimes? And a lot of that goes to this whole business of sexual perversion among white males in the South, going back to the period of slavery and even beyond that, when black males were seen as such a threat, as being more powerful, being bigger, being stronger, being more sexually able than were themselves. So we have a lot of ground to uncover on the question, on the unexplored question of the extent to which black males have been victimized as a result of their relationships, sexual relationships with white women, and the extent to which the attraction between the races has been so suppressed in history as to make it appear to be non-existent, when in fact these kinds of relationships were much more prominent than is recognized today.
That not only does that remind me of Dr. Curry's work, that also reminds me of Vincent Woodard's work in my top 10, The Delectable Negro. Why? And that's referenced frequently in Dr. Curry's book. Wow, that's right in line with his subject matter, especially the absence of whites being lynched with their genitals stolen as a part of the lynching, when that was routine for black males, including Emmett Till, as I am told, that being routine. And Dr. Welsing, she would point that out all the time. There is no case of not just even cutting off the testicles, but sometimes putting them in a jar and keeping them as some sort of keepsake. There's no evidence.
Well, look at what happened to Claude Neal in Florida. Mm. Here's a black man who was involved in a relationship with a white girl. They had been involved in this for years. They grew up together. Claude Neal's aunt's farm was adjacent to this white family's farm. So these two people had a relationship that black people knew about, and the white folks didn't, or they didn't admit that they knew about it. And then Claude was accused of killing this girl, and he may well have done it. We'll never know, because he was lynched and never got to trial for it. But when they lynched Claude Neal, they made him consume his own genitals.
Mm.
And this was a lynching that was announced 2 or 3 days in advance. So there were thousands of people on hand for this incredibly atrocious attack on this man, including what they did with making him consume his own genitals. So this is unexplored territory. If there are folks who are listening who are scholars or historians, or folks who are interested in doing more work along these lines, I would certainly encourage it.
You should definitely read Vincent Woodard's The Delectable Negro, because he mentions Claude Neal's case in that book. And he the full title of that book is The Delectable Negro, Human Consumption and Homoeroticism in U.S.
Wow.
Slave Culture. That's the full title. In
wow.
my top 10, it is extraordinary. But it mentions Claude Neal specifically, and it includes that an example of forced auto-cannibalism. And it talks mm-hmm. that it said all of exactly as you just said, all of this is unexplored, that there are lots of anecdotes of this happening all throughout slavery. And a lot of it is sexualized and things that whites are doing, and even thinking about castration as a homoerotic act of white males focusing on the genitals of another. Vincent Woodard, The Delectable Negro, Human Consumption and Homoeroticism.
I just wrote it down.
In U.S. slave
just
culture.
Wrote it down.
Top 10, and courtesy of Dr. Curry, he's the person who told us, you should read this book, it's fascinating, and it is. Wow. But Claude Neal, you'll get there and say, oh, yep, they spend quite a bit of time talking about Claude Neal's case down in Florida. It has been a pleasure, one of our favorites on the cows, Dr. Marvin Dunn. Again, our residents in Florida, it is mandatory that you have the book, The Beast in Florida, A History of Anti-Black Violence. Get the most recent text, A History of Florida Through Black Eyes. Just spectacular scholarship. You will learn, even if you do not live in Florida, you will learn a lot about the system of racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works. Wow. And pay attention to the governor's race. We'll be looking for the new book. I am going to, if I had to flip a coin, Trump, he won in 2016. I'm going to ride with the president and say that it'll be a thin margin, but they're going to ride with DeSantis, that he will be the next governor of Florida. That'll be that. If I was a wagering man, I would go with DeSantis by a razor thin margin, just because of President Trump. But hopefully I will be wrong, and it'll be new book. You said the first 100 days of the Gillum administration. You want to get the book done?
That's correct. That's okay. Correct. A Black Star Rising, How Florida Elected Its First Black Governor. It will be out about 90 days after the election.
Hopefully we can have you back on the program to review the brand new book, Rising Black Star, with Governor, First Black governor of the Sunshine State, Andrew Gillum. And you could say, I was out there. I was picketing. I battled racism. They were rolling up their windows, and I picketed. I did my part to get him into office, and let's keep it rolling. And all the way to Washington. This is just a pit stop on the way to Washington.
All right. It's been a very enjoyable evening. My wife said an hour at the most and then come to dinner, but it's been a great conversation. I've enjoyed it immensely. Would be happy to be on anytime you want to give a call.
My apologies to your wife. Dinner is super important. Please go enjoy your meal. Thank you so much, Dr. Dunn.
All right. You're welcome. Good night.
Take good care, sir. Context of white supremacy. You can go back in the archives. We spent the entire program in 2013 discussing the Beast in Florida, a history of anti-black violence. There's so much constructive information in that book. One paragraph. Why did hundreds of African Americans die in Florida at the hands of white mobs during the lynching era? The short answer is this. Florida, a virtual wilderness in the mid-1800s, was settled primarily by racist whites who exploited blacks economically, oppressed them politically, disparaged them socially, and dehumanized them morally. Under those conditions, anti-black violence ran amok in Florida. Proportionately, more blacks were lynched in Florida than in any other state. Only external intervention by the federal government starting in the 1950s brought about massive contextual change and a reduction in anti-black violence in the South and in Florida. I will stop there, but the book, spectacular. Dr. Marvin Dunn, always great to have historians on the program. I think I've said it for years now. I was going to say a few times, but I've said it for years, making study of local state history, or wherever you happen to be, we have people that are not in the States, just local, wherever you happen to reside, just studying things that have happened in your area, you can learn a lot of constructive information about what it means to be white, how the system of white supremacy works. One thing I'll check, and then I'll make sure if listeners have any comments they want to share. We were on an hour earlier today, may have really thrown some folks for a loop. We had the whole holiday, so I don't know if folks were trick-or-treating or what have you, but we were on an hour earlier, if that, you know, befuddled folks who are tuning in or what have you, the archives will be available. No worries. But one thing I do want to make sure that I emphasize, the reason that I do think it's very important that we resist the language of there's something unique or special about right now, that somehow things have changed, that things are different than what things have always been in the system of racism, white supremacy, is, again, we're striving for accuracy. I think it is totally ludicrous. It's totally incorrect for us to talk about and say, well, you know, because a white person went and bombed a church or shot up a church, or two white people went and bombed and shot up a church or killed a number of people, that there is something new and different about that sort of behavior, when whites have been doing that for centuries and brag about finding new ways and all the new military technology and interventions that they have created to kill more people and do it in even more exciting ways and have 3D lifetime imaging of people being killed. They brag about this sort of behavior all the time. I think it creates confusion where people are not able to get an accurate grasp of what's happening. And I mean, even, I'm not even saying you got to have like a total grasp of ancient history. I'm not saying that you got to know who Ruby McCollum is or about the history of the Dozier School in Florida, even just recent history. How are we going to sit here and say that things are so drastically different? Didn't they just sit there and call all of the Obamas niggers and monkeys for 8 years? Was I the only one who watched that? Like, that's what I watched. I didn't see hope and change and things are getting better, contrary to what former President Obama said about, you know, things being better and the little children being better. That's what I saw. I saw Dylann Roof. That didn't happen while Donald Trump was in office. Dylann Roof was not emboldened by President Trump. Resist the urge to just, oh, yeah, Trump has created a whole new. No, this is whites practicing racism, white supremacy. Sometimes they are more overt about what they do, But in general, the theme is the same. Terrorizing black people. Nigger jokes are always in season. That is not new. That is not different. Terrorizing black people is always in season. We'll be here tomorrow. Dr. Tommy Curry's The Man Knot. I am so excited to read the book, especially given what we just read with Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. Was able to get one quote from that text today. I asked Dr. Dunn the quote from Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. The black male who breeds with a white female represents the single biggest threat to black liberation. He didn't think that was accurate either. Anywho, the new book, The Man Knot, will be starting tomorrow. Again, the book club is now on Thursday. That is to accommodate listeners who are outside the states who might want to participate. It's very late for them. Stacy, she's been hanging with us tough for workplace racism for about a year and a half, and she said it'd be easier for her to stay up late on a Friday since she does not have to work on Saturday. So reversing it, book club will now be on Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. That's tomorrow for Dr. Tommy Curry, The Man Knot. Wow, what a great book. I had read it, been a year since I've read it, going back and rereading now and just looking at a lot of the thing, a lot of what was talked about this very evening is at the heart of the book and some of the exact issues that were brought up in Black Love is a Revolutionary Act are talked about immediately, and I mean in the introduction to The Man Knot. So excited about reading the text. I suspect a lot of listeners, because this is a new book, basically it's basically been out 1 year, so I suspect a lot of folks have not read it yet. Whew, looking forward. Friday, Workplace Racism, not tomorrow, Friday, Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We will chat it up and exchange constructive ideas then. Compensatory call-in this Saturday, and we should have Global Sunday Talk on Racism back this Sunday, 12 noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. Drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, if you have questions, gripes, complaints, any of the above. Give a few moments if any of the folks listening in have a question, thought, what they heard from Dr. Dunn. Grand conversation. Always nice to talk to historians to give greater context, perspective to things that are happening. Having a grasp of what happened before can help one understand what might happen tomorrow. Briefly, I had so many anecdotes that happened. I will wait and share this weekend. Compensatory call it. I had so many yoga anecdotes and things that happened. I will share them over the weekend. I tried to Facebook about one or two of them, and that sparked a big discussion. So I will share yoga anecdotes this weekend. Always racism and yoga here at the Cows. Person who called in from a block number, do you have a question, comment?
Samiga.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Okay. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers on the line. I just want to make some comments about the things that were said on the broadcast. Cosby was not convicted of attacking a bunch of people. I will say again that he was convicted of raping one liar who changed their story six times, and a lot of the other accusers had a lot of lies as well that they were caught in, and it was not their testimony that he attacked them at all, that these were drug addicts who admitted that they asked him to give them drugs. So they were just people who like to take drugs and have sex. There's plenty of people like that. White people don't fear us, and they don't cross streets when we walk by or when black men walk by or any of that. If they do cross the street, they cross the street to abuse us. White people, they don't fear black people. They abuse black people. Black people don't abuse white people. Why? Because black people are afraid of white people. Black people don't. They don't abuse white people because we are afraid of white people. In terms of them rolling up that window, that was just disrespect. That wasn't fear. As far as single-parent homes, that was brought up. 64% of the children that are in single-parent homes are white, and there are 6 million more white children in single-parent homes than black children. As far as, seeing us as criminals and all that, violent criminals, 59% of those are white. 63% of them are white if you add simple assault in there. As far as seeing us as lazy, 69% of welfare recipients are white. They're only 42% of the poor. They don't see us as lazy. A system of white supremacy, white people should not even be on welfare. They are the ones who don't want to work. Let me see, I'm almost done. As far as like the greatest obstacle, and he made a statement about how we push to be near them. Black people have never pushed to be near white people. If anything, we've pushed to have better schools and better jobs and better homes and all these different things. And unfortunately, white people are the people who have them. So that's what we have always been trying to get. It was never about trying to be by white people. The greatest obstacle to black liberation, it seems to be confusion, which is white people's fault. So it goes back to the greatest obstacle to black liberation is white people. Most people on crack, so-called, are white, and that's always been the case. And that term crack is incorrect, especially when you're using it towards black people. The last thing I wanted to say, as far as murder and all that type of stuff, most of the people who are exonerated for murder, 50% of them are black. For rape, 59% of them are black. For robbery, 62% of them are black. For drugs, 55% of them are black. And for all crimes in general, 47% of them are black. And so I think that's all I had. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. I think, actually, I will have to retract that. I don't know if it's in the book, so we might cover it, we might not. But I do know Dr. Curry has talked about that repeatedly, the high number of black males who end up being exonerated for some sort of sexual misconduct after they have lavished in greater confinement for 10 years or whatever it is. Could be longer than that. Who knows? And then it's, whoops, our bad. Turns out you didn't do this after all. Sorry about that. Don't know if it's in the man not, but he has talked about it on this program and done other segments specifically addressing that as a part of Black Misandry and the study that we'll start off tomorrow. Anywho, other folks, if you have a comment you want to get in, you should go ahead and get a hand up in the next few moments, question or comment. Before we get ready to wrap things up, I will see if the iTunes feed has been corrected so that we can get the most recent broadcasts updated. That has been out of my control, the problem with the iTunes feed not updating. People were still griping about that who used the RSS to access the Cow's content. The archives are still available and current at Black Talk Radio Network, SoundCloud, YouTube, courtesy of Mr. Fox, Google Play, and quite a few other outlets. That's just four right now. I'm sure you can find one of those four. If you are having difficulties, drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. I will post links for all of those sites at Facebook, Twitter, put it on social media so you can access if you have difficulties. But that sort of interference should be expected as long as the system of white supremacy continues. When Dr. Dunn said that they, when he was out doing his campaign thing and the whites would roll up the window, I thought he was going to say that they called him a nigger. That's what I was thinking, because that's what whites do to me. Like when I'm trying to cross the street or what have you, they'll yell nigger, especially here in the Washington State area. I've had that happen here more than any place else. But just rolling up the window, like, wow, if that were on the scale, I would take that. Just niggers out on the corner, will roll up the window. Like, oh, okay, I could deal with that a lot easier than them yelling nigger, and or when they do not allow you to cross the street, and it becomes, you know, is this going to be a homicide thing, and they're trying to running down a black person trying to cross the street. Anywho, let's see, we'll be here announced, so we should be here. Should be Thursday through Sunday, unless, you know, racism interferes. Hopefully you did not participate in any of the madness this evening with so-called trick-or-treating and all of that. Turn your porch light off to keep away all of the madness. If you have children, I hope they didn't have to participate in all of that zaniness. We do not take holidays as victims of racism, white supremacy. And even more importantly, I think it's very important to control our time and energy. I think racists, they do a lot to dictate how we're going to invest our time and energy and the significance of October 31st and what we're supposed to be doing with this day. As victims of racism, white supremacy, I think it's extremely important that we have our own agenda for how we should use our time and energy, and that should coincide with our priorities as attempted counter-racists. That said, we should be here tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, the Man Knot, Dr. Tommy Curry. Excited to begin the book. If you have other questions, comments, untiljustice@gmail.com. Much obliged for folks tuning in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Thursday evening where you could have been doing all kinds of things. I am sure sobriety for sure on this day. Sobriety would be best. If you're going to be out and about, if you got to go do any driving this evening or anything, you certainly want to be sober. I am sure they will have sobriety checkpoints set up, especially if you are in an area that has a high concentration of dark people. Be mindful of that. And it might even be good to just stay in the house, because I suspect even if you are sober, there are going to be a lot of individuals on the road who are not sober this evening. And this is just an excuse for all sorts of incorrect behavior. And a lot of times that leads to violence. They're kind of glorifying that with a lot of this anyway, with the lynchings and axes and blood and all of that. Might be best to just, you know, call it a Wednesday and be rested and refreshed for a Thursday, because racists will be done with the trick or treating and they'll just be back to flagrant racism, white supremacy, November 1. So might be best to just call it an evening and get prepped for an early Thursday. Either way, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Remember the grandcestor, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. Certainly, if you're going to be out and about in a vehicle, we want to be sober and buckled up. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.